David Larson, we are welcoming you. Okay. You are our first interviewee of 16 for candidates to forward to the Joint Committee of the House. And you have an opening statement of 3 to 5 minutes. And talk about your background, qualifications, experience, and interest, and probably what has been most memorable about your experience so far.
Okay. Thank you very much. May I call you Jane?
Yes, Mary.
Thank you, Jane. But before I start, I'd like to thank all of you for doing this, because I think this is an extremely important role that you all are playing. And I believe that it somewhat depoliticizes the whole process, which I believe is a very positive thing. So, in regards to my opening comments, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my career, and that hopefully will give you some ideas about my qualifications. I started out at Cargill as a 21-year-old walk-on. At the age of 28, after being gone in the military for a couple of years, and with only about 5 years of experience, I was named the general manager in Kansas City of our business. It was not a very successful business at the time, but by the time I left it, about 8 years later, it was the largest business in that particular division. At the age of 36, I became the division vice president in Minneapolis, responsible for a number of different things, including a number of businesses in the field, overseeing them. I became the division president at the 3 years later, at the age of 39. The division went from... At the beginning, we had a total earnings after tax of about $10 million. It's now over $200 million. And it is the largest animal nutrition business in the world. I became a group president at the age of 51, in which I continued to supervise our animal nutrition business, but in addition to that, I had all of our cattle, hog, and poultry operations. Our poultry operations were in real trouble. The first, the year before I took charge of it, from a supervisory point of view, not a management point of view, it lost $60 million after tax. And it's now over $100 million after tax earnings, positive, consistently. I was fortunate to become an executive vice president at the age of 55 and a member of the Cargill leadership team. I have supervised over 50 of Cargill's 75 business units in the last over the last 10 years. I had the opportunity and the great experience of being the lead teacher for what we call the High Performance Leadership Academy. It's Cargill's Crotonville, if you will. I started the Marketing Academy and led marketing and brand management for the company over the last 10 years until I retired in March. I think I helped to have a significant role in helping to transform Cargill from a commodity company to a customer-focused, value-added supplier. I supervised business excellence, and during that time, Cargill won 3 Baldrige Awards. First food company to ever win the Baldrige Award, and the first to ever win 3. We've won 3 in the last 10 years. We took employee engagement, which is critical to developing a high-performing organization from 51%, which is about average of the companies that do this, and not very many do, but probably about half of the Fortune 500 companies do, from 51%, which is the average of all those who actually do it, to 76% in the last 10 years. And over half of our units, whether that be functions or business units, are over 80%. And world class is, according to Hewitt and Associates, who are the experts in this area, is 76% or better. And half of our units now are over 80%, and the company overall average is 76. That I am very, very proud of, because I believe it when you have engaged employees, you are going to be successful regardless of the circumstances. A lot of people think that strategy is the key. In my opinion, the key is having engaged employees and let them figure out what you should therefore do. And fortunately for us, we have achieved that. And during that time, Cargill's earnings have gone up more than fivefold. So, one other thing I'd like to mention to you is that I was also the executive responsible for McDonald's, which today is our largest and most profitable customer. And last year, McDonald's hands out awards regionally, and believe it or not, they have two major suppliers that start with a C. One's Coca-Cola and the other one's Cargill. And we won every regional award for the best supplier, and for the first time ever, they announced the winner of the Jim Cantalupo Award. Jim Cantalupo was their former CEO and chairman, and unfortunately passed away about 4 years ago. And for the first time ever, they named the Best Global Supplier Award. And Cargill also won that. Okay. So I'm very proud.
Thank you. Paul Thatcher and then Pat Duncanson.
Sir, when you were here 6 years ago, I asked you a question about what metrics we would judge your success, conduct, your incumbency as a region, and when you came back at this moment, and what would they be, and so on. Why don't you tell us what metrics you think ought to apply now that you've completed 6 years, and then tell us how you account for yourself based on those metrics.
I think we have to compare ourselves to the competition in every regard, our costs, our success rate in terms of graduation, our innovation, and all of those things are extremely important. We have to be extremely competitive. I would say that we are making good progress, but not good enough. Our graduation rates are still, in my opinion, not high enough. In spite of the fact that we have significantly improved the quality of the students, and I believe by and large improved the quality of the teaching. I also believe that we should compare ourselves in terms of best practices, known best practices. We have made progress, but we have not made enough.
Okay.
I would say that in terms of my own personal contribution, I think I have made fairly significant contribution, but I must tell you that In spite of the fact that my background, being part of a very, very large, complex global organization, it was still difficult for the first 2 or 3 years to understand why things were the way they were within the institution. Part of that is cultural. Am I satisfied with my contributions? The answer is no. Do I think that I can contribute more? The answer is yes. Will I be able to contribute more? I'm almost positive the answer is yes, because now I think I have a much deeper understanding of why things are like they are. I consider myself to be a change agent, and I have not been able to make as much change as I would like. But I believe that going forward, we will be able to do that. Will be a change agent leader, especially in the area of instituting best practices across the organization, especially in the area of human resource management. Thank you.
Pat, thank you.
Mr. Larson, thank you for your service to the university. The origins of the land-grant institution and the inherent mission of research, teaching, and outreach in public service. What do you think are the most significant challenges or threats to this mission of the university, and what will they face in the next 5 to 10 years, and how will you deal with those threats?
Well, historically, land-grant institutions, and specifically this one, have been quite dependent on state funding. 10 years ago, this is roughly, okay? Mm-hmm. About 10 years ago, 40% of our budget was funded by the state of Minnesota. Today it's 19%. We have been forced to raise tuition. We have got to figure out some way to take significant costs out of the institution so that we are affordable, and we also have to figure out ways to raise much more money in order to help especially middle-class young people. Lower-class kids qualify for the Pell Grant, and Minnesota still has a fairly significant amount of state aid. But affordability is our number one issue, in my opinion. In addition to that, maintaining a high-quality staff of faculty and administrators is absolutely critical. Competitive going forward in the future. So our value proposition needs to improve, and that's our number one threat, is that we must be able to compete not only with other public institutions, but also private institutions. So affordability and the quality of our output, especially in the area of graduation rates and innovation, is critically important to the future of the university.
Okay. Mr. Esten, did you have a question?
Okay. Not this time.
All right. Who else has a question? Just a minute. Let me see this. All right. David Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regent Larson, one of the things that is critically important to me is knowing from each candidate what skills they have, what ideas they have for the university, and their commitment. You have indicated a number of things that you would like to focus on, I think, if you were to be reelected to the Board of Regents. One of them was HR management. Can you discuss what your ideas are about HR management and possibly any other ideas you have for the university you haven't mentioned?
Well, first and foremost, in order to have a high-quality organization and have high-quality outputs, you have to have highly engaged employees. At present, we do not measure it. We measure satisfaction. And there's a difference between satisfaction and engagement. Significant difference. And if I am reelected, I can assure you that we will be measuring engagement. And it will become part of the culture. And we will become a very, very high performing organization as a result of that. It's a best practice. It's well known organizationally around the world that the top organizations, the most successful organizations, whether they're public, private, whatever, do this. We are not presently doing it. Secondly, there will be a Regents policy that says 100% of all employees will receive written, candid annual reviews with development plans in place. Today, we're at about 80%. That's unconscionable in my opinion. Every single employee deserves to receive a candid, forthright, written annual review and the coaching that goes with it so that they can become the very best that they can be and perhaps better than they ever thought they could be. When you get right down to it, the number one asset at the University of Minnesota or any other institution are the people. Getting the right people on the bus, getting them in the right seats, and providing them the right environment with all of the coaching is what creates an outstanding organization. And I will lead that effort to make sure that that happens if I'm reelected.
Bert?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regent Larson, you indicated that the university needs to develop and communicate a more compelling marketing message to the state's people in order to gain broader support. How do you anticipate doing this?
We need to paint a picture about our value proposition and need to be very, very concise about it and consistent. I think that there are a number of things that are important, but at the top of the importance, graduation rates, undergraduate graduation rates. Second, the economic impact of innovation at the university. And we need to be very, very consistent in painting that picture and provide the metrics to the populace at large about why the university is so important and the contributions that it's making. And put that in terms that the average person can understand and relate to. To have a graduation rate of 60% is not acceptable, in my opinion. That needs to change. So that's number one. Number two is telling the story about the economic impact and the societal impact, social impact, to our state, our country, and our world, and the result of our research and the innovation that has occurred from it.
Okay. Thank you. Margaret and then Paul.
I have a follow-up question to the question about human resources, and it really has probably four subparts to it. Can you give an example of what you mean by a difference between satisfaction and engagement? Because I'm one who took those surveys. That would be number one. Have you talked to new President Kaler about that? Will there be, I'll go ahead, because this is an important area because it's a big area. So one, give an example, does Kaler on board with you? Will you be coaching the people doing the evaluating? And then last question, will there be real money for development that once all of us in our units would say, this is the development that's needed, that the money would flow from that?
Margaret, you're going to have to remind me of those four parts,
good.
Okay?
Yeah.
We'll start off with the difference between satisfaction and engagement. I think there's a fairly significant difference. Satisfaction is, well, are you happy with your environment? Are you happy with your circumstances? Are you happy with your pay? Etc. Whatever is important to you as an individual. Engagement is, are you really on top of what you can do to make this a great institution? Are you really engaged with the mission? Is the mission clear-cut? Do you believe in it and do you live it? It's a huge difference. One is, I'm satisfied. I'm happy, comfortable. And the other is, I'm going to make something happen. It's a great institution. I'm going to make something happen to make sure that the students here have a wonderful experience, a life-changing experience, and that they become disciples from my leadership. That's a huge difference. We are going to become the best. Not second best. We are going to become the best.
And is Kaler on board with
yes,
your family?
I had dinner with him the other night. He's totally on board.
And the money will then flow from there?
If I have anything to do with it, it certainly will. Because this is our value proposition that you as a student are going to have a life-changing experience that is going to make you the very best that you can possibly be and probably better than you ever thought you could be.
Paul Thatcher, can you?
David, I have a question for you way out left field, and you may be the only member of the board that should field this out left field question. You pointed out that we're now down to 19%. The state contribution to the budget of the University of Minnesota. Are we approaching a point where we ought to consider the possibility, as the University of Michigan is doing, of privatization?
Paul, I think we're already headed in that direction. But in order to sustain that, we are going to have to raise a lot more funds for middle-class students, okay? I personally believe in that. I contribute $500,000 a year to middle-class students.
Bless your heart.
And President Brunix matches it, so it's $1 million a year. I will continue to do that for the rest of my life, and I will hopefully be able to raise that amount because it's our middle class kids that are getting hammered. They have two alternatives. One is to not go to school, which is a disaster for themselves and for our society. And two is to graduate with $25,000 to $30,000 in debt. Now, if you're a young kid who would love to be a teacher, a social worker, or something like that,
Are you going to be able to do that and graduate with $30,000 in debt? Of course not. Okay. Is that terrible for our society? Yes. Okay. So people like myself have got to do something about that. And we have to step in. And we've got to get other people to do it. And there's plenty of people in our society who have the means to do that if we can provide them the vision. And I have a process that I go through every single year to pick out these approximately 60 kids a year. And I'd like to have it be 200 or 300. And we can make a difference in our society.
In regards to, if I could follow on, in regard to raising that money, I'm starting to young Palomine, who's probably the brightest star in the legislature, and I was trying to get him to contrast his experience at Harvard in regard to raising money and what we do, or more likely don't do here. And Ryan told me about what happens the first day you put your first foot in Harvard Yard in regard to that subject, and how that continues every day that you're there. And so that now, 10, 12, 15 years after graduation, somebody who was given a 100% Hobo scholarship to Harvard, at night the phone rings and he sees 617 area code, mm-hmm. and he knows it's somebody from Harvard calling him about money, and he's delighted to take the call. It's important. It's an important call. We're so far away from that in our university. We need to be smart about what the successful schools are doing and then implement the plan. It's not rocket science.
It's all about best practices.
Yes, it is.
And picking up and not having to invent everything ourselves.
Yes.
But we can copy.
Yes, we can.
But I can assure you one thing. Of those approximately, this is the third year of my scholarships, okay? So it's going to be the fourth year next year. The first group is going to be graduating.
Okay.
They will be followed up on consistently. I've told them what I expect from them. Keep your nose clean. Do a good job in school. Obey the rules. And do the very best that you can do. And then finally, as you become financially successful, I expect you to give back to others less fortunate than yourself.
Good for you.
Excuse me, it's my job to see that everybody gets a chance to ask you a question, Jonathan.
Regent Larson, obviously with your tenure on the board, you understand the inextricable link between diversity and excellence, and also your understanding of global realities. As the state continues to have a demographic shift, unlike other states around the country, how do you see your leadership playing a role in addressing that demographic shift, and specifically the diversity and equity framework and goals of the university?
I think that is part of becoming a great institution, is to be totally inclusive. And I'm very, very happy to say that at least on the Twin Cities campus, we are very diverse. Our population, our student population of people of color, 18%. That's about double what the state population is. So I think we've done a good job. Can we do better? Yes.
Yeah, I'll push you a little bit. As often in the work I do, people have said that percentage includes foreign students. And
okay.
So if you speak just specifically, and I'll pick
and
one population, our African-American young men in the state have a huge gap. Can you address that specifically?
We have a terrible problem in that regard. There is no question about it. I do not know how to fix that, but it's something that must be addressed. Our Northside project is trying to begin to address that. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anybody has got the answer yet, but obviously, in the Minnesota state penal system, of the males, 70% are African American. That's more than 10%, 10 times more than their
population would suggest. That is a terrible problem. It's not only terrible for them, it's terrible for our society. We have to figure out some way to address it. I wish I had the answer, okay? I don't have the answer, but that's something that has to become a priority. And if there's any institution in the state that ought to be able to find solutions to that, it should be us. I'll tell you one thing I'm doing to address that. We have a program with Minnesota History Day, which is the premier History Day program in the country, where we intervene with middle school students. We hire University of Minnesota students to mentor them, to be a big brother or a big sister, if you will. It's obvious that most of these kids don't have one parent at home who really cares because they haven't done anything. These are kids are referred by the teachers in the school as having some potential, but being a bit worrisome that they're going to get in trouble. So we intervene in middle school, and we hire Minnesota students to mentor them. And today we have about 600 of those kids, and most of them are African American. Okay? Not all, but most. There's 18 schools that are participating. I personally fund that program myself. So that's one thing that I'm doing, recognizing that we do have a big problem. The success rate has been outstanding. And I'm very, very proud of that. And I'd like to build that program so that we have not 600, but 6,000. And the other thing that's great about this is the University of Minnesota students, who are being the big brothers and big sisters, are mostly middle class kids. They didn't even know that this part of our society existed. And they are enriched as people. And I think they will be great leaders going forward.
Okay, can we move on? Thank you, Jennifer. Lois Josephson, then Richard Ispa, then Richard Newell. Lois?
On the engagement question, Mr. Larson, and intersecting that with innovation, my apologies for my voice, how does engagement and innovation and research reaching commercialization interface with the example that you gave of everybody having a bar to get to? So looking at not the student's perspective of are you giving your best, but from the faculty perspective, how would it play out?
It is a difference maker. Having a high level of engagement by all of your people wanting to be the very best in the world at what you do. If you don't have that attitude, that engagement, if you will, it's not going to happen.
How in a unionized circumstance does that come to play in the university? And what steps might the board take to facilitate the commercialization that could roll out of it? How does it enter a unionized circumstance, and how does the commercialization potentially?
I think there's a reason why there's a union. It's because of oftentimes not very good leadership. You get the right kind of leadership, you develop the right kind of culture, people will be engaged. And those who are not engaged should be gone. And it will happen if you get the right kind of leadership. I am a living example of that. Okay? When I went to Kansas City as a young kid, we had a union plant. Okay? Service was not very good. The business was faltering. It had lost money for 10 years in a row. 3 years later, it was the leading business in the division. We still had a union, but we didn't have any trouble. Our customer service was significantly improved. People were proud. And we made examples
of those people that should have been proud. Positive examples. And guess what? The whole culture changed. Everybody benefited, including the employees, because it was a much better place to work. The customers benefited. Everybody benefited.
Okay. Richard, it's...
This relates back to potential income for the university, and I'll be relating it to the research in the various departments. Do you think our intellectual property is being properly monitored and protected, especially in the Hague Park where biotech is moving so rapidly? Or is our university being protected adequately?
I think it's a real challenge. To answer your question, do I think it's being protected adequately? Yes. Am I certain of that? No. Are we optimizing? I don't like the word maximize, because there's a downside to that. But are we optimizing the economic benefit of that? No. Is it significantly better after the Itasca project that I participated in? The answer is yes. But, you know, there's a good news and bad news story about a brand. The good news is it lasts a long time. The bad news is it lasts a long time. Our brand is that we're not very easy to deal with. That needs to be changed.
The U is not easy to deal with.
The general opinion amongst business people is that the university is extremely difficult to deal with.
For commercialization.
Yes. So, do we have a significant opportunity to improve that? I believe we do, and that should bring revenues not only to the university, but to the state and its population. And we are working on changing that. Does more need to be done? Yes. Can I add some value there? I believe I can.
Because of your background and your history, you know the importance of it.
I fully understand the importance of that, and I think I can provide some leadership there.
Just Richard Newell.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about the board itself. Can you kind of talk about the difference between governance and management and what makes for a successful board, or conversely, when a board has trouble?
Well, I think the biggest risk with any organization is the excess of self-interest. I don't think that we suffer from that terribly, but there's always the risk that you're going to suffer from some of that. The difference between governance and management, I mean, obviously, we're not there to manage. We're there to find the people to lead the organization and to manage the manage the business, if you will. I think governance is a lot about concepts and a lot about leadership. Mm-hmm. Setting the right ideals in place, trying to assure that our practices are cultivating the right kind of high-performing culture. So, in my opinion, governance is more about leadership and vision. Vision. Management should be left to the people that we've hired to manage the business, starting with the president. It's our job as regents, in my opinion, to establish the vision, the purpose, and the values that we wish to espouse and to live every single day. That's the difference in my opinion.
And the relationship with the president and establishing the vision, how do you see that?
Critically important. We're the board of directors, if you will. And we have to have an agreement with the president about what are the critical few things that must be accomplished? What are the critical few things in our culture that are central to our future and our purpose? And then the president has to live those values and to demonstrate by his or her own actions how important they are.
Jim Erickson for the last question.
Regent Larson, thank you for attaching your CPI profile. Not many people would do that. Thank you for doing
it's that. Not too damning, is it, Jim?
That's attention to it. Just two light questions, then one final one. Something personal. I see that you, like I, attended Sale College at the University of Minnesota. How should I, and I'm a proud graduate of both, how should I take what heck you left in Old College to go to the University of Minnesota?
I didn't leave St. Olaf to go to the University of Minnesota. I went left St. Olaf to go to the University of the Americas in Mexico City.
And then?
Well, I didn't quite know what I was doing.
All right.
I had a rather uncommon background. This is 1962. I'm graduating from high school. My father sponsored University of Minnesota PhD candidates who were foreign students for many, many years. And so from the time that I was about 7 or 8 years old, about every once a month, we'd have a couple of foreign students spend the weekend with us. And the world was really a huge place at that time. My eyes were about that big, and I got really interested in things international. Today we call it global. Okay? And so when I was a sophomore in high school, we had a foreign exchange student go to our high school and live with us for a year. And that really opened up my eyes even more. And then when I was when I graduated from high school, my dad told me if I was a good kid that I could go to Europe for the summer. So I did, like that. Stayed in youth hostels, mostly traveled with European kids. And that was pretty uncommon in 1962. I went to St. Olaf, and frankly, I was bored. And so I decided I was going to do something else, and my mom and dad were acquainted with the president of the University of the Americas, as he had been retired from being president of Texas Christian, and they got to know him quite well. And my mom said, "Well, if you're going to leave St. Olaf, why don't you go to the University of the Americas?" So I did, and it was a great experience. And then I decided I better get my act together and get back on track. And so I came to the University of Minnesota. And I was fortunate to be able to graduate in 4 years. And they gave me a break, I think.
And I'm sure Margaret would ask you if you remember the Alumni Association. I'm sure you are. So.
Yes.
last question. What was your role in the selection of the new president?
I interviewed him. I was not on the advisory committee. Personally, I think that was a mistake. Not myself personally, but only having one region on it was probably a mistake, and I think that we were fortunate. But I spent a lot of time with the new president in terms of interviewing him. I think I've probably hired
more senior officials, executives than anybody else on the Board of Regents by a long shot. The CEO of Cargill is my mentor, my mentee. I hired him, trained him, developed him, and I've mentored him for my entire career. And many, many other senior executives at Cargill. So I think I know something about that, and I spent quality time with Dr. Kaler, and frankly, I'm very impressed with him. I think we have an outstanding leader for the future of this institution, and I'm looking forward very much to working very closely with him. I think the two of us connect.
Okay, can we have a brief closing statement? We're at that point, that we're at the end of the interview, and if you'd like to have a few words to say to the council.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the great questions. I hope I did a decent job of answering them, and again, I want to thank you for your commitment to this institution and the good work that you're doing. I really think I can make a significant difference in the next 6 years if I am reelected. As I told you before, in spite of the fact that I have probably more experience than any other regent in terms of dealing with a large, complex organization, it takes a while to learn the language, the culture, et cetera, of any institution like the University of Minnesota. I've done that in the first 6 years. I am now advantaged, having had that experience, having the understanding that I have today, and I think that I can really make a difference. In addition to that, during my first 5 years as a regent, I was still an executive vice president of Cargill. I really had a full-time job. And believe it or not, I still am pretty busy. When people find out you're retired, the requests come in and avalanches. But I do have more time, and I still have the same amount of energy and passion to help make this a truly great institution, not one we just talk about, but one that we act on continuously. So I believe that I can make a significant difference with my experience that I've had in the last 6 years. And I will have the passion and the energy to make it happen.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.